right. So the thing is, abalone is that a scrub, right? They call them scrubs. It is a guy who thinks he's fly. He is also known as a buster. And so this is a gentleman who is always talking about what he wants, and he's just sitting on his broke ass.
But isn't he also hanging out the passenger side of his best friend's ride?
He's usually trying to holler at you or
right,
or me.
Right.
Or, yeah, there you go.
Right.
Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you via our brand new YouTube channel, like T-Boz, Left Eye and Chili, better known collectively as TLC, with a message for all the scrubs out there. No, we don't want your number. No, I'm going to give you mine. Abalone don't want to meet you nowhere. Don't want none of your time. Right?
I think that was it.
I am Rylan Grant, fooling it up here. Screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant Banjax and The Jump, which is on Kickstarter right now. Go check it out. The Other Voice in the Dark, if you are just listening. The Man in the Box to the Left, if you are enjoying the show today on our brand new YouTube channel, is?
David Avalone, writer and coffee achiever.
Coffee Achiever. We haven't had Coffee Achiever in a while. It's good. If you missed
it's been a while.
If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated eventually via this YouTube channel. So subscribe, pound that like button. But you can also check us out on audio, pod dishers like Apple Pods and other purveyors of worthwhile crack. So double on back, check all that stuff out. I am tripping over myself. We haven't done one of these in a while, and I am not tuned for this, so I apologize. We have a great guest today. Do you have anything to pimp before we get moving?
Currently in store should be the Savage Tales Winter Special, which I wrote 3 out of the 4 stories in. You can enjoy at least 3 episodes of Batwheels that I wrote on Max. And Drawing Blood up to issue 7 at your local comic book store. How about you have your Kickstarter going on?
Yeah. The 4th issue of The Jump, which is kind of my flagship sci-fi title, is available as you listen to this right now via Kickstarter. So go on and check that out. This is a meaty issue. I take on the election in a really interesting way. So, The Jump posits a world where astral projection is kind of, maybe the best, the most powerful tool in espionage. And so I explore how our electoral process would change if that were the case, or maybe just stay exactly the same. So it's interesting. It's meaty. It's not, it's not a preachy fit or anything. So go check it out. You're gonna dig it. Also, my publishing company, Half Evil Comics. You're watching this right now on the Half Evil YouTube channel. We signed a deal today to get a hold of some great IP. So you're gonna have some
nice.
Gonna have some beautifully crafted licensed comics coming to you from Half Evil Comics that you're gonna be very excited about. So I will tell you about that stuff later. But we are jabbering now, so let's bring on the good people.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lane Morgan joining us.
Hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Howdy.
Good to see you, Lane.
Yes, too.
Tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
My name is Lane Morgan. I'm primarily a television writer, or was primarily a television writer. And I wrote on CW's Legacies and Netflix's Daybreak. And now I am writing comics, which is very exciting. My first comic is
nice. Yeah, that's one of the reasons we wanted to have you on. And it's funny because you weren't writing comic books, but I met you at San Diego Comic-Con, I think.
A long time ago.
Yeah. Introduced by either Jose Molina or Javi Grillo Maxwerch. I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, I feel like you and I met hilariously a little bit in the like Winona Earp world. You were taking photographs.
Yeah, that might be true. That's actually probably true. I have put a lot of the Winona Earp experience out of my mind.
So. Yeah, but that was definitely, I was there for TV reasons and it was a comic. And so we're all at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
But also Jose and Javi.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's right. Because I remember I met you before that, but Jose and Javier were like, we know this person. We love this person. Yeah. So
I like how you introduced yourself because you're like, well, you know, you're like, well, I'm primarily a TV writer. At least I used to be primarily a TV writer because you were talking about how there used to be TV writers.
Right.
And not so much anymore, right?
No.
Because you know, back when there used to be TV writers,
people were making television, and that's not anymore.
In fact, I had just sold a TV show, and it's still at the studio. And there are still three really good actors attached to it, and they're ready to make it tomorrow. But the studio's like, yeah, we're not making those anymore.
Right. What is the television?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah, and I'm like, should we hire people like Lane to make this thing? And they were like, no, we don't. We're not doing that anymore. It's So.
Nope.
Rip television.
So I mean, that leads to the first big obvious question is what prompted the transition? What made you interested in writing comics?
I was fresh-ish out of my TV gig in Legacies and was sort of looking for other stuff, and the industry had kind of slowed down, and in lead up to the strike, we had sort of heard there likely wouldn't be a lot of hiring happening. So it was like the year up to the strike, there was no hiring. The year of the strike, there was no hiring. Then the year after the strike, there was no hiring. Yep. And so I am not one of those people for which writing, and I don't say this from a judgy place because I fully respect it, but I'm not one of those people for which writing is a paycheck. Like writing is a compulsion. Like I just, and I don't say that because I'm very like, it's my art. It's more for me that just like, I absolutely have to engage with storytelling. And with that comes absolutely needing to engage with an audience for storytelling. There's like a small bit of like theater kid in it for me where I'm like, I cannot just write for myself. I have to write for other people. And so I very quickly was like, well, I'm going to go crazy if I don't have the ability to write in television. So what else am I doing? And I started looking into narrative podcasts, and I started looking into comics, and obviously comics is, there's a lot of crossover, I think, with TV specifically, less so with film, but I think with TV, they're quite a similar medium in some ways. And so I started just sort of being like, hey, if a TV writer was going to do this, like, what's the thing? And just asked around, did a lot of research and stuff like that. And I ended up, I had a couple good friends reach out to me, sent me some comic stuff. My old boss on Legacy sent me a bunch of his comic stuff, Brett Matthews and Mark Guggenheim sent me some of his stuff. And it was just like enough people that were being like, yeah, give it a try. Here's the thing, that I sort of just started checking it out. And then Charlie Stickney reached out to me and was like, well, what are you trying to do? And Charlie and I sort of had a lot of conversations, and that was where it like started. But that was probably, it'd be about 2.5 years ago now.
Charlie.
But my first book is only just coming out. So it takes about as long as television. Yeah.
Everything takes time. I mean, in some ways, comics are way faster than television and movies, but in others, like there's, you know, schedules come into play, and it takes, you know, it takes a solid day for someone to draw a page of a comic. So that's a month right there, you know, between the script being done and the thing being finished. So there's that. But how had you just known Charlie from cons? How did you know Charlie?
No, I think we just knew each other from Twitter, or someone introduced. I honestly don't remember. We were just Twitter friends.
I feel like I could have introduced you at a con at some point over the last 10 years, but I don't really
know. I hadn't met him at a con yet, I don't think, because I met him at a con after that. But we had just met on Twitter. I don't know. It was like one of those things where we had just been Twitter friends for a long time, and he reached out.
Twitter also used to be a thing, like TV writing, right?
Speaking of things that used to be things.
Yeah, people don't really meet on Twitter anymore, right? Because it's we're just, it's all the greatest hits today.
this is a time capsule, really. Yeah. Lane, how did you come to exist? Well, there were dinosaurs.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't want to get too far past it, but I like this phenomenon that you're describing. I think a lot of us have wrestled with it. I moved out here to make movies, and I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory with a lot of really amazingly talented people who were more talented than I was, and maybe a little even harder working than I was at the time, and all of these things. And when we got spit out of AFI, there were scripts selling. So if you had a great idea, you wrote right. it, and if it was halfway good, you sold it. And
yeah.
And then things got really hard. And you know, a lot less was selling. The studios are making less movies, more and more. And then, I mean, things got really bad recently. But but what I saw. Again, I went to AFI with a lot of really talented people, and a lot of them are like back in whatever, Pennsylvania, selling insurance or whatever. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's not for me. But they wanted to be screenwriters, and but they held on to that so hard. I need to write movies. I'm here to write movies, or I'm here to write television, or whatever it is. And they are not changing with the times. They are not changing with the situation. And I think it is. What I had to do was I had to become a storyteller. Like I, right. like you, you know, I don't know if it's like a compulsion for me as much as it's therapy. Like I have all of this shit that I need to deal with and you know, whatever, a therapist has been fine, but it's never really been the thing. What has worked for me is getting my demons on a page and beating the tar out of them.
Sure.
And so if I don't do that, I become very hard to deal with. And so I have to do it. So if they're not going to let me do it on a movie screen, if they're not going to let me do it on a television screen, I had to find other ways to do it. And sometimes that was prose, sometimes that was comics, sometimes that was whatever. And so at some point, I ceased to be just a screenwriter and had to become a writer. I had to become a storyteller.
Right.
And so I think the people that did that, like you, are still around and are still, you know, kicking ass and taking names and finding ways to get stories into people's hands. But man, I saw a lot of people just kind of like ride the screenwriter ship down to the bottom of the sea, you know?
Yeah, and it's like the sea keeps getting deeper. Like it's certainly, we're just like, there are new levels of bottoming out that I think Hollywood's doing right now. and that's fine. But yeah, I mean, I television's my thing. And I love television and I love teen soaps and I love episodic TV and procedural TV and like all of it. And so comics to me made the most sense as a shift. You know, I could have, you know, I wanted to write novels as a kid. So I was like, maybe it's not. And it's like, it's not novels. Novels is never going to feel like television writing to me. And I don't need it to feel like television writing, but it was certainly the parts of storytelling that are exciting to me felt really, translatable into comics. I also deeply love the sort of like what I call the like Tetris element of TV writing and comic writing are fairly similar. The like, you know, the sort of puzzle solving of like needing an out, needing your page turns, needing like that sort of the mathematics of it, I find really satisfying and really translatable. But yeah, it was like I just needed to tell stories and I needed to engage in currently. What I'm doing is I'm working a lot as like a script doctor. I get paid to do polishes on people's scripts. I get paid to do like consulting on people's scripts. And so that's where a lot of my survival money has come. My manager, God bless her, has like really bounced to be like, I can't get you work. So can I get you this? And I'm like, yeah, let's go. Like, because there's no work out there. And so she's able to find people who have scripts that need help that have funding. And so I've been doing that and that's great. But it definitely, I sort of was just like, this isn't gonna scratch the itch for me. It does to a degree because it's keeping my toolbox really sharp. If anything, it's making it sharper. But I also just am like, I have to engage with like as probably arrogant and narcissistic as it sounds, like I have to engage with an audience. I have to like put things out into the world. I don't care if like I'm doing a Patreon at some point and it's just me, but like, I was just like, I needed to do something that felt like I could give it to people and people could respond to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. I actually have been doing some consulting the last couple of years as well. I kind of felt I got a development job on the still yet as yet unreleased Red Sonja movie. And that was a good gig, but it led to other opportunities as a editor and development person and all of that. And it, you're right, it doesn't scratch the writing itch. Weirdly, I would say for me, I'm sort of a frustrated college professor, and it scratches that itch a little bit, because there's always a little bit of teaching writing in it. Yeah. You know, you try to do it in the least pretentious, least insulting way possible. Yeah. But, you know, teaching people how story works, how structure works, why, no, that doesn't, you know, it's construction work. As you said, Tetris, no, that doesn't go there. If you put that there, the whole house falls down.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't do that. That is not a load-bearing scene. That is a transition. Yeah. Don't do
but
that.
But there's this way in which you are giving them, I mean, this really profound gift. I mean, I think it was, you know, when I mean, like Elaine, I mean, I was, you know, I was a film guy, and at some point I decided, okay, I want to do comics. And then it's like, okay, well, let's figure out how to do comics. Right. And it's not, you know, you have to learn the math of it. I mean, we were already visual storytellers, so, you know, that's a skill set that you have, but then you have to learn all this other stuff. And particularly if you're going to publish your own stuff or whatever, then that's a whole other hairdo. Right. And so I was the guy sitting in a panel, trying to figure out how to do this shit. And you get great information sometimes, you get really shitty information another time, but then you learn the hard way that it's the shitty information. And then at some point, I had what I thought was all the right information. And then I felt really selfish to kind of hold on to it. And I think that's, you know, that's where Charlie is also. And I think when Charlie reaches out to a person like you, he's like, oh, well, here's somebody who can do this and should be doing this. And so let me hand them a few tools. And I think that's such a noble thing. And it is kind of the mission of this podcast. It is the mission of this YouTube channel. It is the mission that Avalonia and I have taken together when we do all these con panels. It's like, well, let's hand these tools to people. And I've taken that a step further where, so I started teaching also. And so I am teaching, you know, some at-risk youth at La Sierra University, and that has been really interesting. I started last week. I walked into the California State Prison at Lancaster, and I sat down across from, you know, 30 people who had been, you know, convicted of a felony and were inside this institution. And talk about people who have stuff to process and people who have stuff to say and need to be able to express things and need people to like understand the world from their perspective. And that was interesting. You know, it's one thing when it's one thing when you're in an academic setting or you're reaching out to another creative or something like that. But that was, man, that was a cold bucket of water in the face and in a really good way, you know?
Yeah.
And particularly for me, because again, it was this gift. I got it handed to me over time where it's like, okay, well, you have all of this shit that's eating at you. And it is going to sink you. But here is this way to, you know, unmake some of that stuff, to get it out of your head. And I see the same thing happening with them, and that's been really rewarding, and I think will continue to be.
Yeah, I had a guy recently reach out to me through a friend, and was kind of like passed on, and he had written a script, and all I got was like, hey, this guy wrote a script. Can you do some feedback on it? It's not nothing for you to like. He just wants some feedback, and I was like, okay. Then I did my usual script read fee, and which is not expensive, and I read the man's script, and it was a feature, and it was about this really complicated story of like a young high school boy coming out of the closet. And so I went back to him and we chatted for a bit, and I was like, it's really hard for me to tell you what to do with this, because like, is this catharsis or is this something you want to sell? Because those are two different things. And he and I ended up chatting and meeting more. And it turned out he was this, which I didn't know upon reading it until we met. He's this much older gentleman. I want to say he was in his 70s. I don't remember. Who had grown up queer in like the 50s and was like, fascinating, and had like was very happy and lovely and content in his life and was just like, I decided I wanted to write a movie and I just wanted to do it. And so I sat and like kind of coached him through some screenwriting stuff. But at the end of it, I was like, look, I don't want to waste your time. Like, if you want to learn to screenwrite, I can teach you to screenwrite. But if what you wanted was to finish a movie and say, hey, check this out, I did it and it's my story, then like you're done, you've done it. And it's great. Like, it's sort of, it was such a gift for me because it was just such a cool experience. And I feel like as queer people, we don't have a crap ton of like queer elders around. But it was also just like, as a writer, really cool to be able to just be like, this doesn't have to be commercial. You can just use this. I'm so used to telling people like this won't sell or like it needs to be structurally this. And it was really nice to just be like, no, this is a beautiful story and that's all it needs to be for you. That's okay. Yeah. So that was really cool.
I mean, I think that is what is really interesting about comics in general, right? Is that I feel like with film, particularly with TV, it does have to be something specific. It does have to fit into a box to a degree. You know, I mean, some of the best TV, some of the best movies out there challenge what the box is, but the box has to exist for those things to happen. Much more so. Comic books can be anything and everything, right? Yeah. And you can do them any way. And as long as it is compelling, as long as you can connect with it in a human way, it's okay, you know, go for it. I mean, there's less risk, there's less money on the line, there are all these things. And I think that's so interesting. And I think that, I mean, we talk about it all the time on the show where it's like, well, what you can do in Hollywood, the number of things you can do, the number of stories you can tell, it shrinks every day. But I feel like it grows and it grows and it grows in comics, particularly with traditional publishing breaking down. I mean, it was like for decades, you know, 80-90% of the population walked into a comic shop and did not see themselves on the shelf. And that was a big problem. But that's changing in a comic shop. But where it's really changing is go on to Kickstarter, where like half the business is anyway, 2/3 of the business maybe now. And no matter who you are, you see yourself in everything, right? Exactly. No matter what story you want to tell, you're going to find an audience there. And that's another reason to do this, I think. Maybe the best reason to do this.
Yeah, that's what drew me to it, I'll be honest, was the ability to make your own stuff and to sort of not answer to anybody. And granted, this is not to shit on the publishers, because I now have had, you know, I've got stuff in a couple of places and like, I don't like, it's great. And I love them and they're all lovely people. And, but just the initial sort of like, oh, you could kind of do your own thing was really exciting to me. And I've always tried to take that approach in TV, but it's much easier to take in comics because you can drive the boat a little bit. But at the same time, I don't know, I imposter syndrome for like quite a while where I was like, nah, probably not though. I'll do all the research and I'll prepare and I'll think about it and I'll learn how to write a good comic. But like for a long time, I wouldn't pull the trigger. I met my partner, my current partner, through Charlie. He introduced us and it was like a year later before I started writing a comic. Like she and I had been fully dating for a very long time. And I was like, maybe I should finally actually do this comic thing. Like, cause I just got.
It is worth mentioning the hidden piece of information here is that your partner is a super talented comic book artist who I myself have employed
as a comic book brilliant. Artist
recently, in fact.
So my girlfriend is Skylar Patridge. She's fabulous. And I think it's funny because at first glance, I feel like it would be easy for people to assume that I got into comics because my girlfriend's very established in comics, but it was the opposite. I got my girlfriend because I tried to get into comics so that I didn't, then I got a girlfriend. But it wasn't that I didn't get into it. I just kind of stopped and I muddied around back in TV and development and I got paid to write a feature and so I was doing that. And then, you know, the itch came right back and I actually went to I guess this is sort of to circle back on what you were saying earlier, Ryland, about, you know, the ability to sort of teach and share it is I was with Skylar at a convention with Charlie, that I was not involved with. I was just standing behind the table and telling people to buy my girlfriend's art. And we got home and I was home and Charlie sends me this email and he was like, I watched your Legacies episodes. And I was like, okay, cool, thanks. You didn't have to watch my Legacies episodes. And he was like, yeah, they're really good. And I was like, oh, you know, the TV writer thing where I was like, oh, well, we all write it. You know, it's right. such a collaborative thing. And the showrunner ultimately makes most of the decisions. And I was like, but thank you. And he was like, no, I watched the first like X number and I can tell which ones are yours. And I was like, oh, cool, thanks. And then he was like, I was wondering, do you want to write Glary and Thane? And I was like, took me a second because I was just like, do I want to write your book? And he was just like, kind of was like, yeah, I'm thinking of having someone else come on and I read your stuff and it's a little more like punchy and rom-commy and actiony. And I think, you know, your dialogue would be good for it. And that was, I guess, the moment that I was like, okay, so no imposter syndrome then. We're going right, to yeah. do a comic and that's going to be cool. And once he did that, I think I had scared myself for the year before that into being like, no, they're different. They are different. And I have an obscene amount of respect for comic writers and comic artists. And part of me was just like, I don't want to step on people's toes. And I don't want to imply that I can just jump into your universe. And so I had kind of just stepped back. So to have Charlie reach out in that way, I was like, I felt really validated into being like, okay, maybe this is just something I can just figure out and do. And so he really guided me through the scripting process and all of that. And so if you ever read one of my comic strips, it just looks exactly like a Charlie Stickney comic script. But it was also a really nice way to learn comics because it's the exact same beast as television in that you're having to pick up someone else's torch and like play in their playground and write with their voice and do all this stuff. So now I'm getting really excited to do more like original stuff.
And we should say that is available right now via Kickstarter. So hop on over.
Yes, Glaren and Thane is available right now via Kickstarter.
We're doing this a little too late. The Jump number 4 is also available. So why not hop over to Kickstarter now and knock out those two things while you're listening? So go ahead, Evelyn. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, but it sounds like, I did the same thing. I jumped into comics. I was 49 years old. I'd had 9 other careers before this. And when I got the opportunity, I did a lot of research as to how does one write comic books. And I think the only thing that makes people resent screenwriters getting into comics is when you pick up a comic and you go, oh, this is your unsold feature screenplay that you have.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
incredibly awkwardly adapted badly into a comic book. I mean, the fact that you even mentioned page turns when you were talking about stuff that you learned, like that was the first thing I remember learning that blew my mind. Or I went, oh, there's a commercial break every 2 pages. Like there's got to be a cliffhanger moment and it can be much smaller. I always tell people it can be joke. It can be setup punchline. It can be question answer. It can also be hand on doorknob, monster behind door. Like it can be as big a thing or as small. It can be finger on button and the next page can be mushroom cloud. Any number of things as long as the reader is going, oh shit, what's the next page? Let's keep going. And it's a very, very specific form of writing, as is television writing, in a way. And there are genre tropes that come along with the genres that we do these things in. But there are also storytelling tropes. I've said this before, but I think Andor is an excellent television show, but there's a reason why they dropped 3 episodes at once for the first. And it's because you are watching a feature film writer learn how to write television in real time. And episodes 1 and 2 do not have.
You're opening a can. I could do a whole other podcast about it. I don't because I would like to still work in this industry.
I'm not too worried about Tony Gilroy hiring me for anything, so I'm not. And I'm ultimately.
If I have to watch one more 6 episode movie, someone else is going to get in trouble.
But I think by the end of the series, he absolutely does grasp that television shows have to end.
Right.
But 1 and 2, when you got to the end of 3, I went, "Oh, okay, a climax finally appeared at some point."
Run-on sentence.
But it's and the other thing, this occurred to me earlier, but there was a period, 30 some years ago, I was working on my first ever TV pitch, and it was for something that I had the intention would be culty and intellectual and good and all of those things. And I watched The Prisoner, which is, you know, one of the most beloved cult television shows of all time, 17 episodes. And I watched all 17 episodes of The Prisoner. But one of the first things I noticed and took note of is this intellectual, deep, thoughtful, existential television show that everybody loves. There is a fist fight or foot chase or car chase within the first 30 minutes of every episode. Yes, we're talking about late 20th century alienation, but we find a reason for Patrick McGoohan to slug a dude in the face at least once in the first 25 minutes mm-hmm. before that second commercial. Mm-hmm. And that was a great lesson. There's nothing wrong with going, well, I'm making the deepest thing I'm ever going to make, but it's a television show. So, and it's a television show that is ostensibly a sequel to a spy show. So I gotta, I gotta provide the people at home at least a little bit of satisfying spy television show shit.
Right. So that they stay with me,
you know?
And I had the, like, I guess good fortune of learning most of my TV and doing most of my TV writing under guys who had worked in comics previously. Cause there was, there's like a whole era of guys I feel like that are my bosses who like did comics first and then television. Hello.
This is my camera. A great cameo right there.
A little drive by.
Oh, so pretty.
This is Theodora.
Theodora.
I think Brett Matthews, who's my showrunner on Legacies, was a comic writer for a while. Aaron Colite, who's a showrunner on Daybreak, I believe did comics for a bit, or at least was very influenced by them. And then Derek Hughes and Ben Rabb, I believe Ben writes comics. I don't know if they both do, but they're both sort of in the comics world. I don't know if Jose ever has, Melina.
Jose has, and I know Javi, the middleman,
Middleman was a comic.
I loved the comic and I loved the show. I thought they were excellent. One was an excellent adaptation of the other. But
So it's like Hobby's sort definitely. Of like taught to a lot of what I know about television from people who are like, you know, who are sitting there going, no, beat. Like you kind of have to like make your story chug along. And that's also just the kind of TV I like, is that sort of really fast pace. I grew up on the CW. It's like every 46 minutes, there's a cliffhanger. Like you got to go next one.
Yeah, I'm a pacing maniac. As well, like to me, the worst thing you can do to an audience is bore them, and so, keep things moving, keep the surprises happening, and in comics, you can do a whirlwind in 20 pages. You can really put them through something in 20 pages. I'm curious though, when you went to educate yourself, did you talk to people first? Did you read a book first? Did you look at your comics first? Like, what was the how did you perform your education in comics? I mean, did you talk to the showrunners who you had been working with?
Yes, I talked to Brett, I talked to Guggenheim, I talked to Charlie. Hello, my friend. I actually did a lot of reading comic scripts because I need to like see under the hood. This sounds weird, but in a trying to learn the steps way, reading a comic did not work for me. Like I needed to take it apart. When I read it wholesale, it sort of all comes together, which is lovely. But when I needed to separate it and be like, what is the writer doing? That was really helpful for me. And then, so it was a lot of reading scripts and reading scripts for things that I'm super not familiar with or wouldn't have picked up otherwise, just to like really understand how things were working. And that's, you know, that was the same as how I got my television education, reading 200 staffing samples for the Shannara Chronicles. That's just what it is. But it was a lot of that, a lot of chatting. And then after that, I'm just a very like, I'll just do it person. And so once it came time to like proper write something, I didn't over research it and I didn't want to over research it. And cause then I'll get really in my head. I do a lot on like gut. And so I wrote it, but I said to Charlie, like, what are the things that you want to make sure like new writers, what would we be likely to screw up? And he said like, making sure there's not too many words in your dialogue, making sure there's, you know, you're writing things that can be drawn. You know, you can't just be like, this person's sad. Like, what does that mean? And then, you know, hitting your page turns, things like that. And so with all that in the back of my mind, I kind of just, I just sort of sent it, as my dad would say. So, that's where we're, that's what that was. It was, I'll do a good bit of research, but I also try to do as much as I can based on the little tiny storyteller that rides a bike in my brain. And
well, and that's, I mean, that's the important part. I mean, I always say that you either grasp storytelling or you don't. Mm-hmm. That's the most unteachable part. And if you grasp it, the rest is just, you know, a recipe. The rest mm-hmm. is just like, this is in general how you make the thing. Mm-hmm. But if you don't understand story, you're never going to understand pacing. You're never going to, you know, and then, you know, and obviously there are no hard and fast rules to anything. You can have a 20-page comic that's all one conversation. And if you're a genius, you might even get away with it. But, you know, at the beginning, at the beginning, you start out with, you know, what works, what doesn't work, how have people done this before? You know, when I made the transition to writing comics, the first thing I did was go to my shelves and look at my favorite comics and see the stylistic choices made in them. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to see the script. I did read comic book scripts, but like literally the first thing was like, Darwin Cook's New Frontier is only 3 CinemaScope panels a page for like real big movie impact, and it's gorgeous. Whereas Watchmen is 9 relatively cramped panels a page. And both of them break up those forms when they need to. But just like, no, the basic storytelling unit, you know, I use those two as examples because they're so different from one another and they're doing mm-hmm. such a different thing. And you go back and I rarely have had more than 6-7 panels on a page. And when I think about like, wow, 9 panels a page, like how many words, that's not a lot of words in a panel. That is a tight space.
Yeah. I'm writing a graphic novel now and I'm running into that where I'm realizing that for the sort of cadence that I'm using just the setups in general, it's like 4 panels every time. And my editor keeps being like, anything else, anything besides 4 panels. I'm like, I'm trying.
Well, every once in a while. And I worked with an editor once who I will not name, who basically said no splash pages ever. Don't ever do a splash page.
That's the end for me. I'm out.
I did one I sort of ignored his rules on one other comic we did, but it was one of those things. It's like my guess was for a very small publisher, and my guess was that he was probably getting scripts where like every 4th page was a single page. Like he was getting really lazy writers going like, okay, this is a fight scene, it's going to be 2 big pages instead of actually me breaking down actions. And that's the only excuse mm-hmm. I can come up with, because no splash pages is just like literally telling a director, you can't use a 25mm lens at any point in this movie.
Right.
It's like, no, I want to use a 25mm lens. What is wrong with you?
And
you
also, if you're a good writer, you're writing a splash page too. It's not just like, and then you give up for this page. Like, and not to go down the road, but again, my girlfriend is a comic artist and a damn good one. And like, she'll always say like, give your artist a chance to do something cool. Like that's okay. I mean, obviously don't just leave your artist. You know, the poor artist is like, cool, I'll figure this out on my own, I guess. But like, give your artists opportunities to like do cool shit. It's their book too, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, I think some people can take it too far, but ask mm-hmm. them what they want to do in some situations mm-hmm. and give them mm-hmm. options. One of my best friends who I have written a lot of comics that he's drawn, a guy named Dave Acosta. And I think our friendship was formed. The first thing I ever wrote that he drew was a Doc Savage one shot. And I said, look, I have the story, but given the Doc Savage universe, this is a thing that could happen in a laboratory on the 86th floor of the Empire State Building. And then around the top of the Empire State Building, or it could happen at his secret base in the middle of the woods in upstate New York. You want to draw trees. You want to draw Art Deco interiors.
Very different.
I don't care. And he said, oh, trees. Like, I don't, give me trees at night. That's much easier than Art Deco architecture. I would have to do so much. And I was like, great, that's fine.
Sure.
The skyscraper version of that story is not particularly any more interesting to me because it's not a story about where it takes place. It's a story about what happens. So, you know, I think that being open to that and being open to changes like that creates a good, you know, a good rapport with an artist, and they sense that you trust them, you know, and you have to trust them.
I feel that way actually about character design and like costuming and stuff, because I'm, you know, my graphic novel is in, Glaren and Thane, I sort of don't have to worry about it because the characters already exist and the world already exists and the fashion is very specific. And so I didn't, unless I was really making a character up, I didn't do too much of that.
Right.
But in my graphic novel that won't be out until next year, it's set in modern day LA. And we're talking about characters who are look like people in modern day LA. And so there's, you know, there was like one or two characters that I have like a very specific idea of what I feel like they look like and dress like and act like. And the actual lead of the book, I said to the artist, I was like, whatever. Like, I feel like they're this kind of person, but like, anything else, like, surprise me, like, knock yourself out. I don't care. Have a blast. Like, design this character. And I kind of gave them like a paragraph summary of how I feel like that person's personality influences like the way they dress. But otherwise, I was like, do whatever. And then, you know, those people go on to go to events and do this and that. And there were a few times where the editor was like, what are they wearing? And I was like, I can tell you like this person's probably in a dress, but I'd rather see the artist like decide what kind of dress. Cause that's not something, if it was something I had a strong feeling about, I'd certainly put it in there if it mattered. But in a world where to me, it doesn't matter as the storyteller, I'd rather the artist get to like have fun and do whatever they want. Now, if the artist comes to me and is like, girl, I don't understand fashion. Like, what do you want here? Then fine. We'll have that conversation.
Yeah. That's I always start a Pinterest page and dump all the photo reference in there that I can think of, but it's very, but I, you know, like you, it's that thing of like, there's things that are very important to me that are storytelling things. And there are things that are not storytelling things, or that it's the equivalent, what you said about your lead character. You just went to your casting director and said, give me some, who do you think is the lead? And you went to your costume designer and said, this is who she is. You tell me what clothing she wears. I don't, you know, I'm not, that's not my area of expertise. So I'm not going to, you know, tell you what to put her in necessarily.
I mean, it's a conversation. I mean, it is a comic script more than anything is a conversation with the artist. Right. And, and that's so interesting to me. And, you know, and I mean, I come from a film directing background, and before we would ever get anything on film, you sit down with all your department heads and you talk and you talk and you talk and you get each other excited, and you trade, you know, you trade pictures, you trade samples, you trade this, you trade that. And it grows and it becomes something more than you could possibly envision in your head, like when you're locked in an office. Right.
I don't know if have either of you ever done like a tone meeting? I'm assuming this is similar in features to what you're describing. The tone meeting in television, where like before production, you sit down, you go through the entire script scene by scene, line by line with like 30 people. It's like the heads of all your departments and you're flagging everything. They're like, now what does this line mean? What is never in your life will you realize that every single thing you put on paper matters like you do in that meeting. They'll be like, well, what do you mean he goes downstairs in slippers? In the next scene, he runs down a road. So where are the slippers? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I just wanted the slippers to just go, I don't know. But it's definitely one of those moments where as a writer, especially as a, you know, not a prose writer, where you realize that like you're accountable for everything that people see and everything that people do. And then, you know, and to the artist's credit, they're all 30 of those people. They're all of those departments. And so I try to give them, I try to hopefully give an artist not too much work to do, but also let them sort of have the fun of getting to design things.
And there are things that just depending on, you know, if I'm writing Red Sonja and the artist has drawn Red Sonja 1,000 times, I don't need to educate them on Hyperborea or on what a village looks like or what a barbarian looks like. But then you bring in something specific. You know, I just wrote something that's set, that's a Red Sonja thing, but it's set in a city. And I was like, I don't know that Red Sonja artists are drawing a lot of, like, you know, she's running around in the woods a lot and in castles. This is like a densely populated Mediterranean city. And I literally went on social media and one of the, like, I had a scene where she shows up at a hotel. And I was like, what's, I went on Blue Sky and said, what's signage like at a Roman motel? Is there like, is it painted on the outside of the, what the hell does that look like? What tells people it's a hotel? And I, someone sent me art from photographs of Pompeii, where there are literally, it's red paint on a wall. Is how you do that in, and you know, Red Sonja doesn't take place in ancient Rome, but I needed like some ancient version of Mediterranean civilization to lean on, to say it's going to be at least a little bit like this. You know, you have some safety with it where you can deal with having your own interpretation of it. But this is just, this gets you in the ballpark, you know, this
right.
You don't have to draw this. It's like a lot of times I will cast faces and I'm saying, you don't have to draw this guy specifically, but this is the kind of guy, you know, when I did Doc Savage, it takes place in the 30s and I cast him and his five assistants all with 1930s movie stars. Because these are 1930s. These are what men in the 1930s looked like. These are the faces.
Right.
And I'm not saying draw Gary Cooper, but he's that kind of looking.
Should feel like that. Yeah.
You know, it should feel authentic like that. And, you know, as an overall thing with research, I always feel like there are places where you can fudge it. But I always feel like what's right will feel right to the audience, will look right to them, even if they don't know why, even if they have no idea. Oh, yeah, that feels like the 1930s to me. They don't know why it feels right, but it feels right.
Right.
But yeah, no, go ahead, Ryan.
Finish. I was just gonna say, I love finding the key. I mean, from, you know, I used to do the first panel I ever did at San Diego Comic Con was a directing your comic book, panel. Yes. And I got a couple of really good creators up there and I cast the comic book writer as the director of his or her own film. And this idea being that, well, comic book writing, it is like screenwriting, but it is also like directing. All of the notes that you would give to your department heads, they all go into the comic book script, right? And that's what makes this really interesting and really challenging. And you know, and there are these very on the nose literal things like, okay, well, this character drives a cool car, and if they just draw a random car, then that doesn't say anything about the character. So what car does he or she drive, right? Blah, blah, blah. That's very, very obvious on the nose stuff. But I remember, like, you know, key moments in filmmaking. I did a year at the LA Film School a long time ago, and I directed this film. Without context, it's going to sound insane, but it took place in India. The film was in Hindi with English subtitles, and it was kind of this homage to Ray Zappu trilogy. Really, really interesting movie, and you are trying to prep a cinematographer. You're trying to prep a designer for this movie, and it does not behoove me to give them images of India. They know what India looks like, right?
They also have access to Google.
Exactly. And so I can sit there and I can fill a comic script with images of India, and it literally does nothing, you know? And again, like, I mean, Lane, you hit it right on the nose. It's like, well what does your artist want to draw? Like, let them, they're probably going to find a more interesting, you know, place in India. But I had to come up with like a visual motif. It was almost the key to the visuals of the movie. And at that time, I have an art history degree. But I had fallen in love with the paintings of Lucian Freud, and he was this really kind of a bleak British realist painter. And it was this interesting thing because here I am, I'm this white guy in LA and I'm directing this movie that takes place in India and it's in Hindi. And we don't need to get into how and why I was directing that movie, but I was directing that movie. And so I'm doing it and I'm trying to make it authentic, but it is also through a Western eye. Right. And so, mm-hmm. so how better to kind of embody that than, okay, well, you know what this British realist painter did, let's do that with this. And as soon as I said that to the designers, like, it just all made sense. And then it dictated every decision. It's like, okay, well, we're making this movie that takes place in India and the costumes need to be right and the environments need to be right. However, we are viewing this entire thing through this lens. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? And everybody ran with it. Right.
Yeah.
It was just so interesting. And right down to, so Lucian Freud was, you look at his paintings and looking at him in a book does not do them justice. They're beautiful. They're bleak. They're ugly in the best way. They're haunting. But they had, they were almost three dimensional. He would grind lead into his paint. And so when he painted a nose, it wasn't a flat nose. The nose built up. All the face had undulation and there were actual wrinkles and all of these things. And so the production designer fell so in love with this that when she had to build India on a soundstage in Los Angeles, and when she was doing interiors, she was mixing sand into the paint so that the environment had the texture that a Lucian Freud painting would have.
That's amazing.
And it was beautiful. It was amazing. And every decision was dictated like that. And so, like when you're, I don't know, you can just write a comic script and you can just put pictures of India in there. But you're not making the most of the art form, right?
Right.
Like you got to find your key. You got to find your thing that gets everyone excited and gets everybody break. I didn't tell her to put sand in the paint. She did that on her own. And it
right,
was brilliant.
Right.
And it was beautiful. And the film was so much better because of it. And there were 100 decisions that were made that way, mm-hmm. because we all agreed on this thing that we were going to filter everything through. And I think that's,
yeah. I mean, I think it's like the tone thing, you know, it's important to know what the tone of your book is. And that is also in the like aesthetic tone. And I, again, for this one book I was doing, it was important to me. It's like, it's set in Los Angeles and that could mean truly 100,000 things. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want it to feel real because our characters live in Los Angeles, but I want it to feel aspirational. Like I want it Los Angeles through the lens of like, wow, living in LA would make me feel really cool. And that's like, which is different from the vibe of like, it's LA, but it's sucking the soul out of your life. Like there's like, it's like, this is, you've got to know what angle you're approaching. I think that's a helpful way for me as a writer to talk to an artist is like, it's not just, hey, a wide shot of LA. It's like, we're seeing LA and I want the reader to feel like this is the coolest place you could be. And that right. would get a good artist is that's, they're going to come in and pick that baton up and give you that tone in their choices and likely know more about how to do that than I would. I'm not going to be like trying to explain to them how to make someone feel that way. That's their,
right.
That's what they're good at. Mm-hmm. But I think if you know like the feeling you want your pages to evoke or your book to evoke, it's much easier to just communicate that sometimes, yeah. I think, than being overly descriptive.
And if you communicate it successfully to your team, they are thrilled and they know mm-hmm. they know what language we're all speaking, you know, yeah. at the same. I mean, the thing that Skylar did for me was a post-apocalyptic kick-ass lady. And one of the, I found Skylar's drawings of Tank Girl. Online.
She random. Just made me watch Tank Girl for her birthday and I loved it.
That is hilarious. I yes. love the comics and I love the movie and I don't think the two of them have much in common with one another, but sure. they're both equally enjoyable. But I saw Skylar's drawings of Tank Girl and I went, mm-hmm. okay, well, she gets snotty post-apocalyptic Riot Girl character. So cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Ben Bishop told me I had actually met Skylar before. And no, yeah. I hadn't accidentally discovered her on the Visible Woman hashtag on Twitter. I had actually had dinner with her in Albuquerque. But it was
She's
at a table
with about-
She's
been visible to you this whole time? I yeah. can't see her.
Yeah. It had been, it was at a table with about 15 people. So, and sure. I was at the, yeah. literally it was, you know, me waving, oh, and that's Skylar. Oh, hi, Skylar. That was it. Right, that was, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the whole interaction.
We're thinking next Comic-Con or next Halloween, we might do a, we might do a tank girl, jet girl. Full.
Nice. That's a good.
I'll let you guys figure out who can be who.
Yeah. Abalone and I were going to do the same thing, but.
Come on, let's go.
Well, my.
I'd love to see that.
This Halloween, I leaned into the cosplay I'm always accused of doing, and I did Commissioner Gordon. Because I'm done. I'm in the outfit.
Sure.
The cosplay is finished.
You're halfway there.
I just need to literally put a tie on and I'm good. And my wife, because she's a genius, I said, so what do you want to do? You want to do, you know, I was like, Batgirl is creepy because that's his daughter. Let's not do that. I said, do you want to do Catwoman? And she said, no, I want to be the bat signal.
Good. Very good.
The most important thing in Jim Gordon's life is the bat signal. So I'll be the bat signal. So she made there like a skyscraper dress and put an actual.
I think I saw that on Facebook. Yes.
Yeah. And put an actual working bat signal on the top of her head. Gosh, I actually gave her, I had a little Hero Clicks Batman. So she bought little fake gargoyles for her shoulders. And one of them has a this tall Batman standing on it, which is
perfect. Very good.
But we like to do the occasional couples costume.
Yeah, we were gonna do Supergirl and Lena Luthor, and we still may at some point. But the thought of putting me in a Supergirl outfit just felt really overwhelming. So we ended up doing basically the same thing. We were the sun and the moon last year, which was a lot of fun. This year we didn't do that, but. Yeah, we were the sun and the moon. And now that we've watched Tank Girl, I was just like, I have to wear a Jet Girl outfit at some point in my life. So that's the
amazing.
Plan. Sure. Plus, I just feel like Skylar could do Tank Girl pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. And, you know, and also that's one of those movie star moments where, you know, Naomi Watts had never been anything that anyone had seen in the United States. And, you know, watching that movie, you went, yeah, Lori Petty, whatever. Who's that? let's spend more time looking at her because that's Naomi Watts and she's spectacular. I enjoy that movie. That never makes lists of like comic book movies. I'm like, no, that's very much a comic book movie. You know?
Yeah, it was delightful.
Yeah, it was. I believe I saw it on opening night. I was that big a fan of
amazing
Tank Girl. And I was, you know, I had enough of the cynicism of like, no, they didn't get an Australian girl. It should be an Australian girl.
Sure.
I am just not the kind of nerd that gets tied in knots by stuff like that. It's just not.
Right.
Not that.
And you liked it? You saw it like.
No, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was a. There were a lot of like sort of not big budget action movies in that era.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very much a like where you'd make like a post-apocalyptic sci-fi movie for like $11 million instead of $150 million. And you'd lean into the like, well, the sets are the desert and abandoned industrial complexes and factories that haven't been in business in 20 years. And that was enough to make a dozen movies exactly in that framework. A friend of mine made a movie called Cherry 2000 that I think is a fucking masterpiece. And it's another like filmed on 3 cents. Have you ever heard of it? It's Melanie Griffith playing a bounty hunter in post-apocalyptic Southern California.
Ooh, wow.
Okay.
A guy's sex robot short circuits. And it can only, he has saved the chip from her brain, the body's toast. And there's a warehouse of sex robots in Las Vegas.
Of course there is.
And he hires Melanie Griffith to get him through the Forbidden Zone to Las Vegas, which is, you know, engulfed in sand. It's a very funny movie.
On a life or death mission for the sex robot vault?
Yes, exactly.
Just to clarify, course, making sure we're in the right place.
And of course, he falls in love with Melanie Griffith and realizes that he really maybe shouldn't be doing all of this to revive.
So thematically, we're talking about a quest for a thing that isn't real, only to find out that authenticity is more.
Yeah, and all it's okay. Very
I'm
much.
Here. Nice I'm here.
Nice no, it's very much the like, and love is the people we met along the way. You know,
right.
Love isn't the quest. Love is what we learned on the quest. But yeah, it's a delightful little movie. I recommend it. It's got my favorite line in any action scene ever. There's an incredible stunt. Just an absolutely incredible stunt of a car being carried over a giant quarry by a magnet, by a crane with a magnet. And if it halfway falls and machine guns and rocket launchers, but there's a moment where the car slips from the magnet and goes vertical. And you think Melanie Griffith has fallen off and she climbs over the side of the car and says, "I swallowed my gum." And it's just more action scenes where the action hero says, "Oh, I swallowed my gum."
Right.
It's just very Steve DeJarnat is the director of that. I recommend it. But and it's a very it's a very comic booky, very very tank girl kind of movie as well. But so you've got the book with you've got Glaren and Thane with
Charlie.
Is that a graphic novel? Is that floppies? What is that? What's the...
Glaren and Thane is a, I believe, roughly 50-page one-shot.
Okay.
So if you're, for those not familiar with Charlie's White Ash universe, he has White Ash, which is a modern fantasy series. And then he has Glaren, which is a prequel series to that series. It's about Glaren... who ultimately ends up the mother of the protagonist in White Ash. But she's like a badass assassin and it's very sexy and very violent. And White Ash is a bit more of an adventure.
Yeah.
And he tasked me with writing effectively the Romancing the Stone action romance story of how Glaren eventually meets Lillian's father.
That's great.
Thane, and how they sort of come together. And they had a meeting in another book of his where like you see Thane having met. And in some other things, you see him as an adult. So this was getting a chance to sort of write that, like, how did they fall in love beat? And so it was really exciting. Charlie came to me with like a, he's credited, I believe in the book, with like with the stories by both of us, because he came to me with like a pretty solid grip on like what he wanted out of it. And then I sat with it and I was like, okay, so emotionally and thematically, what are we doing and how can we make it sort of sing? And then out popped Glaren and Thane. And so it's this really fun, action-y, romance-y, witty banter. Glaren is, of course, a major badass, and Thane is like the most arrogant motherfucker in the world. And so it's, they get tasked to go on a mission together. And yeah, it's all about their balls coming up or down and murder. Sure. And you
know. If there's anything I've learned from working with Kevin Eastman is that true success is when you don't have the time to write every version of your thing that crosses your mind. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's a success when you go, and also it's great to learn how to let go of it and go, you know, I don't have to write all this. The thing that Skylar drew for me, I had Amanda Dibert Staggs write it. Because I was like, this doesn't need to be me. And it's supposed to be written by a, you know, 16-year-old tattooed rainbow haired girl.
Right.
And while Amanda is definitely not a teenager, she's been a teenage girl and I have not.
Right.
And again, it's not that, you know, I've been successful writing Betty Page and Elvira. It's not like I
of
feel
course.
Like I can't write a woman's voice, I think. That's a crazy thing for any writer to not, but like a teenage girl, if I can not do that, if I can not have to write like a teenage girl, that's great. I'm thrilled to let someone else do it. And also the joy of seeing what other people do with your characters and how they take them in a direction that you might not have. You know, and you also get the experience of going, oh, hey, that sucked. That wasn't what I wanted. That wasn't what I wanted at all. I've been very lucky. Yeah. I have not had that experience with things that I've been, you know, where I've subcontracted writing to someone else. I've always been very happy with what I got out of it.
But I mean, it's
very carefully.
I mean, it's the primary lesson from a TV writer's room, right? And the greatest argument for diversity in these elements, because it's like, well, if you want a three-dimensional world, right? And you want, and, you know, there are things that I know backwards and forwards, and there are points of view that I don't. And at the very least, I get with somebody who has walked in those shoes, and you know, I've never been a Hell's Angel before. The last thing I got paid to write in Hollywood was about Hell's Angels in the 60s. And, I read a lot of action-y kind of ass-kicking characters, and so I got that. But how does it sound like a Hell's Angel? What are the politics of a Hell's Angel? What are the values and what are the hopes, dreams, and fears of a Hell's Angel? Like, I can imagine, but what is better is driving down to Ventura, hanging out with a bunch of old Hell's Angels and asking them a bunch of questions and getting their phone numbers. And when I end up in a bind, I get to call one of them and be like, hey, so guy bumps into you at line at the grocery store. What happens? You know? and I promise you, whatever three of those guys tell you is going to be so much better than what would have fell out of your brain.
So between them and the prison, no one should fuck with you, is what you're saying. That's what this is like. Someone out there has threatened you, and you're like, I got to make it really clear in the podcast that I have really strong friends.
Got a couple of friends.
Got a lot of danger. You know,
But I do think, you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's, you know, being a good writer. I mean, my father impressed this on me. Being a good writer is listening, is eavesdropping, is
Time my writing sucks.
But is listening, you know, is listening to how other people express themselves. And it's, you know, you can be very successful and be a writer where everybody talks the same. There are a couple of those out there. I do not personally always enjoy that. That can burn me out fast. I'm like, wouldn't it be nice if someone walked into the room who didn't sound like the showrunner writing in their blog? But you know, and that's why, you know, we've talked about this on the pod before, but I'm a particular enemy of the auteur theory. And when you're in a really good working relationship, really great partnership, who remembers who came up with what? Like, it's, you know, in a good meeting where you're kicking story around, I couldn't tell you who had which idea. I know when I sit down at the paper and it's blank and I'm typing, you know, where most things are coming from. But unless you're on the stage when a movie is being shot, you don't know who had what idea. You don't know who contributed what thing. And being able to synthesize those contributions is what filmmaking is. But you do see, like, there are showrunners who you see, they, and I'm not going to name the name that's in my mind, but there are showrunners that you see that do a show with a writer's room and the show is great. And you go, well, this person is a great writer. And then they write a 6-episode series themselves and you go, oh, this is terrible. Without 8 other people in the room, suddenly this person doesn't know anything about writing. And how does that happen?
Yeah. And I think that's the writer artist thing too with comics, is it's so easy for people to be like, oh, this, give the writer all the credit, especially for, you know, some of the bigger books. And it's so easy to then look at a piece of art and be like, wow, I can't believe the artist chose to draw this. And the artist's like, I didn't, like, someone told me to. And like, so it kind of can always go back and forth. And that's where I think it's really good, is when you have that almost inability to untie it. I was actually telling Skylar recently about this experience I had where I wrote this line of dialogue in a scene for an episode of Legacies that we did. And it was something along the lines of, like, one character looks up at another, like, like a port in a storm or a lifeline or whatever the heck the line was. And when I watched it, the actress, who's one of my best friends, like, just, it was so moving. And all the fans were like freaking out. And so on Twitter, I was like, guys, I'm gonna be honest with you. All I said was this. And like, she did all that with her face. And then I told her about it. And she was like, what are you talking about? I did what you told me to do. And I was like, just the like complete inability to discern like whose thing fed on whose thing was like a lot of fun.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I got to say, that's, as a writer, it's the similar thing when you write something. I cried the first time I got a page of comic art that I had written
an
email and looked at it and went, oh my, it's so beautiful. Like it's really beautiful. And this person recreated something that I wrote, you know, I wrote something and they made this beautiful piece of art out of it. And what you were saying about the scene in Legacies reminds me of, I read an essay written by Comden and Green, who wrote the screenplay of Singing in the Rain. That was just like liner notes for the soundtrack album. And they talked about the writing of the script and how the ideas came about. And, you know, and literally I love, like, this is what's great about the connection between art and commerce. The head of the MGM musical division comes to them and says, we got these 10 songs from the 1920s that we haven't used in a movie in a while. Write a movie that uses these 10 songs. Right. Like the most nakedly dumb commercial idea in the world. We got 10 songs we don't have to pay for. Mm-hmm. You got Gene Kelly and you got Singing in the Rain. You Were Meant for Me. You Are My Lucky Star. All I Do Is Dream of You. Here's your 10 songs. And they wrote this, they were like, and we were thinking about, oh, the songs are from the 20s. Let's put it in the 20s. What can we do in the 20s? Oh, let's do a thing about the transition between silent and sound films and all that. But in the liner notes, one of the things they say is like, we should be clear that we did not write in the script. And then Gene Kelly performs the greatest solo tap dancing routine in the history of film. Like we neglected to give him that instruction. literally says Gene kisses Debbie Reynolds goodbye. She closes the door. And as he walks down the street, he breaks into Singing in the Rain musical number.
And then they fight.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, next page, interior, you know, RF's office morning. Like this is, that's it. Gene walks down the street and sings the song. But then Gene turns that into as magical a thing as anybody has ever put on film. But, you know, part of that is knowing it's Gene Kelly. He's going to be fine. He doesn't need a lot more direction than Gene has fallen in love. And we are expressing that in this sequence. And that's why musicals work when they work, is that it's, here's the big emotional moment. We're covering it with a song, you know.
Yeah. Power of collaboration.
I mean, and the other version of that, which is my favorite TV writing story ever, is late in the production of the Dick Van Dyke Show. There's a scene where Dick Van Dyke is getting ready for a gala event and he's putting on a tuxedo. And in the script, the writers wrote, Dick puts tie on funny. And Carl Reiner walked into the writer's room and said, so I should fire you all and let Dick just do physical comedy for 25 minutes?
Yes.
That'll give me a show. But if your idea is that I'm going to pay you for writing and then Dick does some brilliant piece of physical comedy, you know, like Dick does. It's like, write him a fucking joke, assholes. Like, you know, he will then also put a tie on funny and it'll be the greatest guy putting on a bow tie gag you've ever seen in your life. But I'm afraid we need a joke for him and Mary in the scene as well, you know, or I don't need you, you know?
Yeah.
So I had two movies come out this last year. One of them is terrible. The other is very good, in my estimation. And that seems to be the read on the whole thing. And I feel like as a writer, you write a script and I don't turn in a script I don't think is good. And here's the thing, is that the development process can make a script not good.
Yes, it can.
That happens very often. In both cases with these movies, the script that they started shooting, they were both good. I'm in a position to say that, is that the development process did not kill the script of the terrible movie. It was a great script. And a lot of people said that. And but you spend a lot of time as a writer of films and of TV also just hoping, praying that if you give them a good script, that they're going to capture it, that they are just going to capture what you wrote, right? And not just what you wrote, but maybe what the room wrote or what or what the development process gave birth to that was great, that you love. With the terrible movie, we had a great actor who gave a great performance. I mean, he is in there and he is throwing 100 miles an hour. And you could cut together 20 minutes of him acting and be like, this must be the greatest movie ever made. But the director did not understand the script fully. It's a little bit of a kind of psychological mind bender that has a setup and a payoff and all these things. And he did not capture ultimately what was in the script. It just isn't there. You watch the movie. It's not, well, you know, well, I'm not getting this. I'm not getting this. I'm not getting that. Well, it was all in the script. And it's terrible and it's a tragedy. Like I am not made angry by a bad film that was supposed to be a bad film. But when a film could have been good and it should have been good or even great, then I'm made livid. Particularly because you had a damn good script and then this actor came in and gave a great fucking performance. But you didn't get it on camera. So there's that experience. The other experience was this other movie. This film Haunted Heart that I did with Fernando Trueba, who's he won the Oscar for foreign language film for Bella Poc a few years back. He's a master. He's awesome. You have Matt Dillon who's amazing generally, and there's this actress Ida Fulch, who is a Spanish actress, who just gave like the performance of her fucking life in this thing. And so again, I turned in what I thought was a pretty damn good script, right? And again, you sort of, I mean, I knew I was in good hands, but you cross your fingers. I hope they just get what we wrote. And I watched the movie, and the movie they made is so much better than the screenplay.
Nice.
It's so much better. Like
that's how it's supposed to work.
The photo play that Trueba built around this script, because the script is just it's a blueprint, right? And sure. and the house that they built. I mean the visual motifs, the way he used the space, the tension he created with the imagery was so beautiful. Matt is great like he always is, but Ida, you talk about your actress friend. Performance that Ida gave, like I wrote a pretty good part for her. She turned it up 10 notches. She's giving in every scene, she is giving so much more than is on the page, and she makes me look so brilliant. So of course I take credit for all of it. But it's like that's the ideal experience, right? And and I have so rarely felt that in film and in TV, I think. And I get it a lot more in comics.
I think that one of the early things I learned actually when I was a film editor, I would say that 90% of bad film acting and bad film directing is that they just don't understand the scene.
Right.
They don't. And I, you know, this is a vast oversimplification, but I think writers are ironists. We are generally ironic, sarcastic people. Directors and actors are earnest as hell. And they will read your sarcastic line like it's the straightest thing in the world. And you go, no. Let me tell you what. And it's funny, like I worked with an actor once who was absolutely unschooled, had never been taken an acting class in his life. And all he needed from me is if I told him, like, and he wasn't, like, he couldn't parse the script. He didn't understand the script. But if he would come to me before every scene and go, David, what am I thinking about? And I would say, you're thinking about the money. And he would go, got it. And then he would give me a performance. The dialogue didn't matter because what you would see in the character's eyes is, oh, he's thinking about the money. You know what I mean? Like he knew how to do that which is actually the hardest part of, you know, I can't remember who said it, but like you let the camera get close enough to you to read your mind. And if it can, everything's great. And if it can't, if you're not capable of that, in the 1950s, when CinemaScope comes in, there's a movie called Vera Cruz that stars Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster. Gary, coming from the 30s, had a style of acting that was, well, in the really important moments, I'm going to need, like, I need the camera right here because I don't do much and I need you to see it in my eyes. And the director of Vera Cruz is a very good director, but he will not get within 5 feet of Gary Cooper because he's got this big CinemaScope screen to fill and he's scared. So he never, there are no close-ups in the movie. It took Sergio Leone to go, CinemaScope, I don't care. Here's a close-up of an eye. Like, you know, no one was doing that until Sergio. But Burt Lancaster sees the camera 20 feet away from him and goes, I'm going to make enough noise and pull enough faces that from 20 feet away, you're going to know exactly what I'm thinking. I'm going to reach out. But Cooper didn't have the, he was used to directors going, okay, right, for the big emotional moment, Gary, we're going to come right in on your eyes and we're going to feel your pain and your whatever. But when a director wouldn't meet him there, he didn't have the like,
right,
well, let me be, he couldn't be Burt Lancaster because it was also inappropriate for the part, but it's an interesting matrix of like, I think that's one of the hardest things about filmmaking, about film directing, is it's very rare that you get three lead actors that are from the same school of acting and are good on the same take.
Right.
And I've had actors, I shot a movie once where the lead actor had one good take in him and the lead actress needed 20 to get ramped up to it. And I got into the habit of, I would shoot his close up, then I would shoot the master, then I would shoot her close up. Because that was the only way for her to have done 20 takes by the time we got to her close.
And neither of them had ever done network television where you get three takes and that's it.
No, God, no. That's the...
Sorry, guys, we're out.
Yeah, no. And people who really know what they're doing, working with actors who really know what they're doing, it's two take. The second take's the safety and then you move on. That's the, you know, we don't, we're not screwing around here.
That's how Clint does it, right? No, that was fine. Yeah, but Clint, I sneezed in the middle of the main line. No, it's cool.
Yeah, we'll cut around it. It'll be fine. Well, we should wrap things up. People need to look for Glaren and Thane on the Kickstarter, and we will obviously put links up with the video. Brilliant. So that people know how to find it. What is this Los Angeles based book you're writing? Does it have a title? Do we know anything about when it might be out?
I'm not allowed to say anything about it yet. But it is an original. It's my first ever original thing that I'm being paid to write. Everything else I've been paid to write other people's things. For TV, for movies, all of it. A movie is an adaptation. So this is my first ever original. Ooh, as I punch myself in the face. It's my first ever original. It's with Maverick, which is the YA imprint of Mad Cave. So I'm doing that book. It should likely come out next year. It's nearly done writing, but we've only just started drawing it. So, and it's a graphic novel. So there's a whole year's worth of work an artist is going to have to do on that before it exists. But that will exist at some point. In the meantime, Glaren and Thane Kickstarter is out on White Ash's stuff and on Charlie's stuff and on my stuff. And I am also, ideally in the next few months, we're launching a Kickstarter also through White Ash with Charlie for my original series that White Ash is going to publish. So
Mazel Tov, that's really great news.
Yeah. And Skylar's drawing it and I'm writing it. So we're gonna co-create.
Do you have a title on that yet?
Currently it is called Run. It's the pilot script that I wrote that was originally a novel that was originally like 100 other things. And it's, you know, gotten enough love that I just want to make it and I'm sick of people. So we're going to make it. It was the reason Skylar and I met. Charlie introduced us because I was looking to make it to make a comic.
I see.
That's, we're going to finally do it. And Charlie's going to publish it. And here we are.
That's well, maybe when it's live, we'll have you and Skylar on together to talk about
that. Would be great. Yeah, that'd be so fun.
Love yeah. it.
And where can people find you on the interwebs?
People can find me on all the socials. I'm everywhere. I haven't deleted anything yet. We'll see. I'm Lane Morgan everywhere. Just my name. It's pretty easy. Straightforward.
Excellent. And Ryland, where can people find you?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. If you're just listening, and a lot of you are, that is R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. I always have to spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so, yeah, now I got to spell it for you.
I feel like I should have spelled mine now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yours is it is
also not a real name.
A left of center spelling. I like it though. It's got some punch to it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Just like Ryland Grant.
look at us.
But along with Glaring and Thang, my comic book The Jump, my flagship sci-fi series, is available on Kickstarter right now. We take on the election. It's a good book. Go get it. Another thing where the artist has elevated it. I'm really like, my batteries are sapped right now. I'm running low. But Haunted Heart is available on streamers right now. It should have like a big kind of Netflixy thing coming up very soon. Stay tuned for that. Big announcements coming from my publishing company. Got some branded stuff coming, so it's going to be really fun. Stay tuned. Bring us home, Avalonia. I'm powering down.
My parents gave me the first name that was the most common first name in the year 1965 when I was born, because they felt like Avalonia was going to be enough of a hard thing for me to carry through life. But in the fullness of time, I always say in the 21st century, it's nice being very easily Googled. And the first 11 pages, I believe, of David Avalone results on the Google or DuckDuckGo, if you're avoiding Google now, or Bing, are about
me. I share my name with a porn star whose name is Morgan Lane, and no shame. Nice. So, but it does make a little internet search quite exciting.
Yeah, the second David Avalone shows up about page 11 or 12, and he is a lieutenant of a retired U.S. Army lieutenant and lawyer. Seems like a very
nice,
very intelligent and impressive guy. So happy to share the name with him.
There's a Grant Ryland who was an NCAA volleyball player who seems.
Oh. Yeah, see, we just get the flip flops, the backwards ones. But yeah. I got Lane Staley, but we have different last names, but it's the same spelling.
Nice.
Good.
Yeah, there's infinite number of Davids born in my in my generation. Yeah. It's literally.
I occasionally have people say, "Are you named after Lane Staley?" And I'm like, "Well, no, because I'm in my 30s." Like,
just doing the name, right? Interesting though, when things are, I met a woman roughly my age once whose name was Cinnamon, and I said, "Wow, your parents were big Mission Impossible fans, huh?" And she went, "How the fuck do you know that?" I was like, literally, there's one, you're my age. The show was on the air when I was born, or she was like a year really or two younger. And like, that's the only Cinnamon in pop culture, ever. So like,
yeah.
I'm sorry that's not actually that shocking, Sherlock-like deduction.
My daughter's best friend, her name is Remy. And they were watching House of Cards when she was born. So it happens.
Yeah. I'm like, no, I'm not named after Elaine Staley. That would make me quite young. However, I am a child of my mother, who is a child of the 80s, and I am named after Paige Turco's All My Children character was named Melanie, and they called her Lainey, and my mom thought that was cool. But she didn't want to name me Lainey because she was afraid it was too cute. So sure. Here we are.
Wow, that's very. I don't necessarily believe them, but I am supposedly named after, because my parents are quite a bit older, or they're gone now. But I am supposedly named after Cary Grant in Bringing Up Baby.
Okay.
Who also had glasses. So, like, literally, they doomed me to be a easily flustered nerd, I guess.
It was never going to be. There are
worse easily flustered nerds to be, I'll be honest.
Though the theory that I have, which has nothing to do with Cary Grant, is my father's full name was Michelangelo. making me Michelangelo's David. So I think my name is a classical art joke, not a screwball comedy joke. But anyway, getting back to where we were going with that, DavidAvalonifreelance.com. I'm on all of the socials, though I have gone private on Twitter. I am probably most easily found on the Blue Sky. And it is nice over there, and there's a nice comics community growing on the Blue Sky, which I encourage everybody to be a part of. And
I post my cats a lot on Blue Sky, so highly recommend.
You post your cats a lot on Blue Sky?
That's all I do on Blue Sky. It's like, here's my cats.
That's good. Cats are a very big part of the internet. And
I think so. Bring that back.
Yeah.
It's gotten like way too Nazi heavy when it could have just been a place for cats, you know?
Could be. I post my collection of rare Hummels on Blue Sky, and it's very well received. Yeah.
Exactly.
People who love cats, they also love rare Hummels. So I'm in.
Probably.
Yeah.
Sorry, David. I can't.
No, that's okay. You know, we love this. I've been quiet for
the last 30 minutes, but now I have things to say. I'm like a kid before you try to put them to bed, and they're like, wait.
No, it was great having you on, Lane. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is great.
It was good.
And we'll see you all on the next exciting episode of The Writers.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.